All right, welcome on to Dunked On here. Day 6 in the health and safety protocols. I can tell you for certain that there's no way I could have played in a play-in game against the New Orleans Pelicans. I'm not even sure whether I made that joke on our 20-minute pod about DeAndre Ayton. I don't even remember doing that podcast. It's been a blur, but I think it's mostly behind me here now. And lots of news is behind us as well. I think where we need to start, of course, is with the slightly, maybe even more than slightly expected news that A, the Jazz, lo and behold, are listening on Donovan Mitchell, and B, that the New York Knicks are the primary suitor.
Right. And so this started with reporting, I believe Woj had it first, that the Jazz are showing a willingness to listen on Donovan Mitchell trade scenarios. And
and we should add also, there's been plenty of reporting saying that, you know, that like from Andy Larson, for example, that no, actually they were listening much
before,
earlier.
Yeah, exactly. That they discussed it maybe even before Rudy Gobert trade. And that's not surprising considering Danny Ainge, he's going to listen. He's going to talk. It's not, they're not maybe. And maybe they did a little bit of that to garner some intrigue when he became more fully on the market. And this is a different trade negotiation than the one that we saw for there, and we'll continue to see for Kevin Durant for a few different reasons. One, Donovan Mitchell is significantly younger. He is 25 now, will turn 26 before the start of the coming season. Also, Donovan Mitchell, to this point in his career, has not been as good as Kevin Durant. Kevin Durant in the conversation for best player of the world, and Donovan Mitchell is one of the better shooting guards, if we're going to classify him as a two. Some teams will see him as a one and everything else. And also because the Jazz in particular, and this will come up in a few different facets during this conversation, could potentially be looking for a different kind of return. And what I mean by that is Brooklyn, because they owe all of these picks to primarily to the Houston Rockets as a part of the Harden trade, the incentive for them to be weak is diminished. Diminished does not mean zero. Like we talked about those incentives and the swaps and everything else. However, the Utah Jazz, now that they've traded Gobert for a pick-centric package, their books are pretty clean. And if they traded Donovan Mitchell primarily for future assets, their team quality would be pretty weak. And so thus they could start maximizing draft capital right away. That is not the only path for Danny Ainge here. If they wanted to do Donovan Mitchell, they could do it for players that will help them more currently. They could do the players who are already in the league but are young path as well, you know, like current rookies, current sophomores, even just drafted players, you know, that came up. Jeremy Lamb, if those remember, was in the Harden trade after having just been drafted by the Houston Rockets. So I think there are a lot of avenues here, but the overwhelming dynamic difference between this and the Brooklyn situation is that if Utah values the quality of their own draft pick this year, there's an incentive to move Donovan Mitchell earlier rather than later.
Yeah, their incentive is definitely aligned in that direction. And also, frankly, it's probably less of a big deal to have this happen deep in the offseason locally than right during the middle of the season. And the Knicks are very motivated. You know about all the CAA connections and that the Knicks have basically been pursuing him since Leon Rose came in 2020 and all of his New York connections. Most of the reporting seems to have indicated that this is going to end up in New York. New York, particularly if the Jazz are prioritizing draft picks, has the best package among other potential suitors. Miami is really the only other one that we've heard to really be interested. Obviously, Toronto is another one that's been bandying about a little bit, but I don't think the Jazz are really that interested in, you know, obviously they'd be interested in Scottie Barnes, but he's not going anywhere in a Mitchell package. So really kind of what this comes down to, there are a number of factors at play influencing what the value is going to be. Obviously, Utah is going to say, well, we got this for Rudy Gobert, and we think Donovan Mitchell is younger and better and on a cheaper contract and under contract for almost as long, so give us even more than we got for Gobert and we've got a deal. The Knicks will say, hey, what other offers do you have? Oh, Miami? Okay. Tyler Herro, you don't even really want that guy. He's going to be matching salary. Duncan Robinson, that's bad salary going back. We've got more expiring-ish contracts than that. We got way more picks than everyone else. We'll offer you slightly more than anyone else can offer, and that's where you're going to get. So that seems like kind of how these these negotiations are going to go. The question of who is going to cave off of either of those positions is an interesting one. As you mentioned, the Jazz, like, I don't think they really want to go into training camp with Donovan Mitchell. Like, not that Danny Ainge can't handle the awkwardness necessarily, but more just that they don't want to win games. Do they want to be, like, sending Donovan Mitchell home? Do they want this, like, massive distraction? They'd like to get these young guys in. If there are going to be young guys, say, from the Knicks, that, you know, they've got their Quentin Grimeses and those sorts of guys, those will be some inflection points in the deal as well, and how they get valued. Grimes just had himself a nice summer league. So all of that is going to play out, but it does seem like, for the reasons we talked about, namely that that's where Mitchell wants to be, and that the Knicks can beat probably any other offer, that he's going to end up in New York. It's just a question of what the price is going to be.
It's a question of what the price is going to be, but also something I consider in this is the different ways that an offer can be strong. And so the Knicks, they have some, you went through all the different resources they have, but
I didn't. Let's go through that.
Yeah. Okay. I was talking about more like Grimes and some of those things. Yeah. We could go through all of it. So from a pick perspective, and presumably that would be a key part of this deal, the Knicks have all of their own firsts moving forward. So that means if they want to ask for, you know, unprotecteds or swaps or something like that with their own, they have that. So you just consider that in the back of your mind, you have all that. On top of that, they have protected firsts from Dallas, which probably conveys in 23, Detroit, which could convey at any point over the next 6 years, the Wizards, that's like kind of a version of lottery protected descending starting in 23, but I'm guessing if that pick conveys, it's probably more like 25. If it conveys at that point, I think we have a Watville on it. The Bucks pick in 25, assuming it's not top four. So none of those to me, there's a lot in terms of, you know, if you use the Knicks specific picks, you could potentially get upside if you think there are going to be down years towards the end of that. But the protections on the non-Knicks picks do diminish the absolute best case scenarios. And if you think about the comparison between Danny Ainge's trade with the Nets, with the KG Pierce trade, and this, is that not only, you know, those non-Knicks picks, do they have, they're protected specifically against that upside. None of those become unprotected. They're all revert to seconds. But the Pierce Garnett situation, those guys were older. I think Ainge saw the possibility, maybe not to the extent that it happened, that the Nets could be weaker towards the end of that. And if Donovan Mitchell, he's, you know, 25, 26 soon, wants to be in New York, then the odds of getting a pick that becomes the next Jaylen Brown or the next Markelle Fultz / Jason Tatum, that's probably a little bit diminished.
Yeah, you'd think so. And the Knicks can always be the Knicks. Although I would certainly say that this regime's competence is higher than any that they've had really maybe since the Donnie Walsh era, as far as at least having a plan, and they've done a pretty good job of executing it. It doesn't seem like RJ Barrett is going to be in this deal. It doesn't seem like, frankly, Utah really wants him to be in this deal. I don't think I want him to be in this deal either. And it's been so interesting, as you noted, the different situation, for example, that Brooklyn is in. And we're seeing this with Tyler Hero as well. Like, oh man, Tyler Hero, sixth man of the year, like, and, you know, still on a rookie scale deal. Like, oh no, actually you're going to have to pay him at least $25 million a year and possibly more than that, and he's going to want a max, and so is RJ Barrett. And well, I mean, do we really, like, as a rebuilding team, like, this guy can't really be a tentpole piece for us. I don't know if he's even going to be tradable on this contract. Like, we'll just take some drugs. Whereas Brooklyn might be interested in guys who could actually play in the KD deal. So that is kind of a fascinating dynamic. And when the deal eventually does happen, as it seems like it probably will, you never know. But how all this is going to fit together from the Knicks' perspective will be a very interesting question. Not that that's been a huge concern for the Knicks in the past. But getting back to the idea of the Knicks' future unprotected picks, like, this seems like a regime that at least somewhat knows what they're doing and isn't very interested in bottoming out. They may have a different coach at some point that could possibly change that, at least within a given year. So yeah, I think if I am the Jazz, I'm still gonna be prioritizing further away unprotected Knicks picks more than these other ones. And what I'm saying is, hey, you give us your whole draft going forward as a starter, and hey, you know, you'll still have these other picks that you could possibly use in other deals. From the Knicks perspective, I think they realize, even with Donovan Mitchell, this isn't a championship level team. I don't really get the fit of him and Brunson Brunson, frankly, as two small guards. We kind of saw how that worked for Utah's defense. But again, for the Knicks to get to where Utah has been the last few years, I'm sure they'd be quite happy with that. But I think the idea is you get Mitchell and now you can potentially trade for another star who might want to go there. And then you're really cooking at that point in time. The question just becomes what's left in the coffers. So for New York to not pay too much here is critical, as we've seen, for example, when the Lakers got Anthony Davis. Like, yeah, they won the championship that first year with some unusual circumstances, but they didn't have much left in the cupboard, and what they did have, they squandered.
And that's also been a criticism of mine of the last, not of the Jazz, but of the Timberwolves in the trade with the Jazz, where it was the picks that they gave up for Gobert made it hard to add that next piece, and also for the Atlanta Hawks in the DeJounte Murray deal, that when you give up that much, so the Knicks are trying to balance this and finding, if let's say this ends up being eventually a Knicks Jazz deal, the number of firsts, I'm sure there will be some excited tweets about the historic number of picks involved in the trade. Which firsts far more important than the number of firsts in this deal because of the disparate quality of some of these different resources and some of them just potentially reverting into seconds or, you know, not a ton else that's there. Anything
this
else?
Can't be a, I was going to say, this can't really be a WATFO because it's hard to measure objectively. But when it's said and done, are we going to look back on this Knicks at the time of the trade? Obviously, much depends on the fortunes of Minnesota and New York going forward. But are we going to say the Jazz got more for Gobert or Mitchell?
Gobert. Especially
how insane
because
does that seem?
Especially because they took no negative contracts. Like the idea of how that all worked. I mean, I think we're going to see Danny Ainge and the Jazz flip some of the pieces in the Gobert deal for positive value moving forward. Like Patrick Beverley, if they make a Mitchell trade and want to do it. And I would consider those further assets in the Gobert trade. If you take Patrick Beverley or, I mean, Walker Kessler, you could just keep him. Vanderbilt, you could just keep him. But if you end up moving some of those, like that is another thing. Now, the Knicks don't have that much bad salary either, so they could do it in that trade. But I think they get more for Gobert.
Yeah, and let's see what players come back from the Knicks too. Like, surely Utah will probably be saying, hey, give us your whole draft. And then we want Obi Toppin, Emmanuel Quickly, Quentin Grimes. And, you know, and some of that's going to be because we also got to take back
Fournier probably.
Yeah, I mean, Rose will surely be in this because he's an expiring contract and you don't really need him once. But that'd be the second time Rose got traded to Utah, and probably, although I don't think he'll necessarily get bought out. Maybe he'll play there and get flipped. But in 2018, he got sent there and bought out too. And that's how he ended up in Minnesota and resurrected his career. But in any event, yeah. So I think that for the Knicks, Quickly, Grimes, Toppin, if I could move Toppin and save some future draft equity, I would certainly do that if I'm the Knicks. Probably Quickly too, honestly, because again, with Brunson and Mitchell, like, do you really need another small guard at that point? So if you can save yourself a future first by putting Quickly in the deal, I would do that as the Knicks. Grimes to me is the guy. He's still more of a two than a three, but he's like the one guy in this team who can shoot other than, you know, Fournier will probably be in this deal. And, so Grimes will be really important, I think, for them to keep going forward just to have a good team. Of course, the other question will be, you know, what does this mean for Julius Randle, who will be now probably the fourth option, a role he is ill-suited to play on both ends, and as a complimentary player. So they'll be looking to move him, and Randall's big extension that he signed on a 3+1 just kicks in now. Although, granted, Randall did play better down the end of last year. I don't think he's going to shoot quite as terribly as he did, but he's also just not going to get as many opportunities as he did in the last 2 years with the Knicks either, probably no matter where he is going forward. But clearly they would really want to move him, but that might be difficult. So they're going to have a lot of, even if they get Mitchell and they get Brunson, like, they're gonna have a lot of work to do building this team into something that actually makes sense. And I think they've done far better with talent identification and with building up their resources in the draft. Like, Brock Aller gets a lot of credit for that in their front office, and obviously having a tactically Neanderthal coach doesn't help you much there either. So they're gonna have a lot of work to do here, assuming that they do get Mitchell. But I'm fascinated to see where this ends up, because the Jazz being able to create leverage in the same way that they did in the Gobert trade. The Gobert trade was apparently like, hey, we'll just keep him unless you meet our price. That's less compelling now that they've already traded Gobert.
Yeah. So can they manufacture other suitors? And part of the way they might manufacture other suitors is teams that would enjoy seeing the Knicks pay more, like, for example, the Miami Heat.
Yeah, but again, I mean, Miami, it's been said they can only trade 2 first-round picks. They can probably most likely trade 3 even now with first available draft. They could go back to OKC for the 97 billionth time to try to make 2025 unprotected. I might not actually even agree to that if I'm OKC. I don't know how much more Miami can really offer them. And, you know, Miami can offer some swaps and stuff as well. Obviously, apologies for the error on the KD trade where we gave them too many swaps potentially to offer. But they can still offer 3 picks in theory going forward. But I think you would rather have Knicks picks than Miami picks. And I don't think Hero is something that the Jazz are really interested in. And the matching salary is going to be Duncan Robinson, which I actually think could be rehabbed and flipped. Like, I think the league is way too down on Duncan Robinson right now. Just the fact that Max Strus is better is no huge stain on Duncan Robinson, particularly as a regular season player. But unless somebody else gets involved, maybe a Toronto or something, but then Toronto and potentially Miami are kind of holding on for this KD thing to resolve too. So I expect this is going to take a while, unless the Knicks cave and just offer so much right now. But if I'm the Knicks, I'm not going to do that. I'll take this in a training camp. Fuck it. Like, let's...
Especially when you're not pushing as hard. Like, seeding does matter for this year, but this is not a trade just about 22-23. Like, you can line things up for the playoffs for future years, and if, you know, there's no reason to just give everything right now and, you know, oh, you get the 2 seed that you need that to win the championship this year. One other piece
one more thing. I mean, on Mitchell too, you know, between him and Gobert, him being only 25, you know, that's pretty remarkable. 3 years left on his deal. And this is the sort of guy where players like this don't become available this early on. It's a new trend, right? It's basically, you know, even AD, he's a little younger than Mitchell. So I think he was 26 when he got traded, but he only had 1 year left on his deal at that point. But obviously there was a thought that he would extend and be with the Lakers for a long time. That's what ended up happening. That in theory is what's going to happen now in New York as well. And so that's the fact that he's this young and can be around for a while. I mean, that just, you know, Kyrie, I think, had 2 years left on his deal. So he might've been a little bit later on when he got traded, but usually these guys are further. So in terms of age, this isn't quite unprecedented with Mitchell, but in terms of time remaining on the contract, it is. And so presumably the Jazz will be looking for a huge haul, but I'm just not really sure how precisely they are going to get it, or at least force the Knicks into it. And so maybe at some point Utah will be like, hey, you need this guy, you want him to start the season and you want to win the press conference, and do the Knicks cave the way the Lakers did? Or do the Knicks say, yeah, we'll give you an offer that's better, you know, slightly better than the other offers that you have? And maybe Utah will just say, no, we're not trading him for that because we're pissed off that you guys have essentially tampered with him for the last 2 years. And fascinated to see where this ends up. All right, I think I'm done on that, unless you got anything else.
No, the one thing I want to add in as a different piece of Jazz news, they signed Simone Fontecchio, who had played at Basketball.
Simone, sorry.
It's
okay. I've been screwing up Paolo Banchero.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. So no, I just screwed Banchero. Up again. Paolo Banchero. Banchero.
There we go. So Fontecchio, I was unfamiliar, played at Basconia, 26 years old. John Gavoni said that he is the best available international small forward prospect. He will be a member of the Jazz for the next 2 years, 2 years, $6.25 million. The Jazz have plenty of financial flexibility now after the Gobert trade. We'll see how much they have after a Mitchell trade, should one occur. And the next thing to talk about briefly, I don't think we need to spend a ton of time on this, is when we recorded that podcast after the Ayton sign and match, our assumption had been at the time that this was going to be the 3+1 full bells and whistles, 15% trade bonus, all that. That ended up not being the case. The deal Ayton signed with Indiana that then, you know, got matched in substantial, you know, the whole thing with the Suns, does not have an option for the fourth year and does not have the trade bonus. So that is good for the Suns. That means that Ayton couldn't find a team that was willing to offer that anywhere else because do that. And it's also notable, I would say in some ways, kudos to the Pacers because they signed a deal that was more team friendly, that they were more comfortable with, even though there was a distinct chance that became a reality almost instantly that the Suns were going to match.
And Casey Johnson noted this because he lived through this saga back in 2018, that it was a similar offer sheet to the one Zach LaVine, who had the same representation, Bill Duffy and company, as Zach LaVine back in 2018. Aiden and LaVine both had that same representation, sorry. That also was just a full four-year offer sheet with no option. And I probably didn't focus on this enough in our initial analysis. Like, great job by Bill Duffy. Like, he played it right. He got his client the offer that he wanted eventually. And so really good work by him. And whatever it was that inspired the Pacers to do this. And I mean, if I were them, I would have just given him the full boat mini offer sheet. Maybe it's just that Herb Simon still doesn't believe in that. Maybe Herb Simon didn't want to get stuck with an offer sheet where he would have to pay 50% of the contract in cash by October 1st. That could be part of it too. But in any event, that was surprising to see an offer sheet like that. Few other contract minutia. John Wall's second season is actually a team option.
Really like that for the Clippers, by the way.
Yeah.
And so that mitigates some risk in case John Wall doesn't look great. And I don't expect to see the, you know, opt-out non-bird rights way to, you know, because you could theoretically do that with John Wall, and I think it would be more likely to use early bird rights, so you pick up that option, or maybe even do a, you know, Batum where you the option gets declined and then you bring it back. You know, it could be a circumstance like that. But the 20% raise off of John Wall's salary, probably not enough if he ends up establishing himself as the starter of the present and future. But for the Clippers, I mean, you get out of that. I thought this might be a 1+1. Instead, it is a second year team option. So good negotiating from Warren Craig.
Clippers, generally, for a player like this who just hasn't played that long, like, to be in the tax situation they are and be giving up a player option could have been difficult if he got hurt again or something. And we saw them just recently decline the team option on Zubats and then give him a little bit longer of a deal. So maybe they could do that with the Wall. They have the flexibility to do that rather than if it were a non-guarantee, they couldn't have changed it anyway. So I think the team option rather than the non-guarantee is the correct approach here. Where do you want to go next?
Well, we could talk about Zion. As we're doing kind of contractual minutia, it does appear that, according to ESPN, that Zion Williamson's extension, the structure is similar to Joel Embiid, where it is not fully guaranteed, but it is going to take letting him go and letting him go early to get out of that. And so, you know, I haven't seen the exact contractual language in Zion's case yet, but after the Embiid circumstance, my read on it, which is what I did the whole time after I saw it, was treat it as guaranteed, and then if something really bad happens, then we will of course assess at that time.
Yeah, and we don't know precisely what it is and what body parts. It could be the foot, it could be his knee. Those are the two things that he's struggled with, but it's still, and we don't know when the triggers are as far as when it would guarantee, and is it related to games played or not as well. So it's similar to Joel. We always thought that would be the touchstone. That was one that, well, in theory, it's more one of these things where you can go to the owner and say we're protected and it looks like you weren't negligent if things go wrong. But like you said, the only way that this is going to protect the Pelicans, probably, or that they would even want it to protect them, is if he suffers he's missing like the next two seasons or something, like, or he misses all of this year. Maybe at that point they might consider moving on from him, but I'm not sure. I think they're still understanding that it's like at least $100 million is fully guaranteed, and then maybe the next couple of years are non-guaranteed, but, you know, again, only protected if there's an injury to this one body part or whatever. So it'll all be pretty complex, but the upshot is it probably doesn't protect the franchise that much unless it's just like such a severe issue where he's just like not playing at all for multiple seats between now.
We also got deeply disappointing news from the Pels in Summer League, where second round pick AJ Liddell out of Ohio State had been looking good and came back in a game. It seems like it was unrelated, but he goes down with a right knee injury that becomes a torn ACL. And Liddell, I believe he was the 41st pick in the draft, had not yet signed his first NBA contract. So this is a very complicated situation with the Pels. Maybe you give him like a two-way, or you work with something like that. And both sides are probably going to, you know, but remember, the Pelicans have, part of the reason this is such a complicated situation is that the Pelicans have a roster spot issue. And so if they give a fully guaranteed contract to Liddell, which they may have been intending to do before the injury, then they're burning a roster spot for this entire league year on somebody who cannot play for them. And I think this is going end up being something with a two-way, and then you make him whole. Maybe you convert him at the beginning of next year. Like, you could even structure it as a 2-year
deal. Or a trade deadline or something, yeah. Or, you know, Willie Hernan Gomez gets shipped off at the deadline,
sure.
Or they waive Garrett Temple, and they try to find, I mean, they have their full mid-level still. So, yeah, that's probably how they end up playing with this. But, yeah, this is, I think, the first time we've seen a guy, because he hasn't signed his contract yet, as you noted, so for him to suffer this injury, and it used to be that a lot of agents would be like, wait, if you haven't signed your contract yet, like, we're just not going to have you play in summer league. And so you probably, the Pels, I assume, will make him whole in that regard. And he probably would have ended up with something where, with the full guarantee this year and maybe a partial next year for the 41st pick, that's about what the market has been for guys like that. That's right around the borderline where guys start taking two ways as well. So maybe it's not insane that he starts off on a two-way, at least at this point in time. But we'll have to put a pin in this one to see where it ends up, because this is a rare situation where a guy gets injured before signing a contract who's a second-round pick. Obviously, if he's a rookie-scale guy and he gets injured, well, you know, that's still the contract that you have to sign, right? Like, they have to tender him that offer, and then he can take it.
We don't have a ton of signings. We'll get to some of them, but we have fully entered non-max extension season. So there's that max extension window, you know, Zion and Darius Garland and all those guys, Ja Morant, that happens. And when the non-max contract extensions come in, it's always a question because, you know, these are often market setting circumstances. They're a year out. So it's not like Anthony Simons where this is replacing their cap number or anything like that. You're doing this looking ahead. And also, these are important signposts in terms of where different teams, and each negotiates different, but where these teams and players are seeing the league's finances going. Because, you know, like, and I think you will see some higher numbers than some would expect because of the expectation that revenues and potentially the salary cap will be going up for a couple of years. And I think the place to start is in San Antonio. Keldon Johnson, 4 years, $80 million. And that's a non-max number, but it is a damn high one. I like Keldon Johnson a lot. He, of course, was on Team USA. He can be in the forward mix for them. But this is also significant because San Antonio still has an ungodly amount of cap space, 423, should they want to use it. But Keldon Johnson making, let's call it $20 million, it's probably going to be a little bit less than that once we see the actual terms. I would actually front load this as the Spurs, but you don't usually see that happen. But the reason why is because it's way higher. It's about 8 to 10 million higher than his cap hold. So that space is vaporized. But for Keldon Johnson, you get that money now. You get it committed to now. You don't actually receive it.
Yeah. So the 4-year 80, I'm guessing, as is the want for these sorts of deals, there will be some incentives involved. So bake it in at maybe more like 18, 19 a year in sure. terms of what the initial cap number will be, depending on how he plays this year, whether those will be considered likely or unlikely incentives or not. There'll probably be some stuff based on team success, which Spurs may not have a ton of that this year. Johnson would have had a $11.6 million cap hold for next year. And so this will probably bump that up. As you mentioned, you might start it big and decline it. I don't think the Spurs are going to be big cap room team. This seems like they're starting on more of a lengthy rebuild. There are going to be other teams that are further along in the cap space derby, like OKC and Houston next year. So like you, I would probably start it earlier and decline it. The only downside for that is that as you get further out into this deal, declining it, you may be unable to build another palatable extension on the end of that for either them or a trade suitor. But this is totally fair for Johnson, who had a nice year, average in the high teens, hit 40% from three, although not a huge volume guy. He's still not an incredibly respected shooter yet. But I think this is fair value for player and team. And we'll also consider the fact that two of these seasons will, for all these extensions, now we're going to start talking about it, two of these seasons will be under the new TV regime. And I think this will end up being, you know, yeah, all right, you compare this to OG Anunoby. OG Anunoby is better than him, but OG Anunoby got a player option, and that was...
And a shorter contract.
2 years. Yeah. Well, via the player option.
Sure.
Yeah. It was a 3+1 rather than 4. But, and I think we talked about this offline, the timing of this, it's rare that a non-max rookie scale extension will be signed this early. Robert Williams actually was an interesting one for last year. My thought would be that the Spurs are like, hey, we need to get this done now, because if you're not willing to agree to an extension, like you may be in some trade talk, and that's why they were able to get it done. And they offered him something that was pretty fair. And I'm sure for both the player and the agent, being able to get to that round $20 million a season figure probably played it in this also. So I think that this is exactly what a rookie scale extension for a non-max guy is supposed to, where you're probably paying him a little bit more than the production he's shown so far, but a worthy gamble for a team, for a player who, with the cap rising, could outperform this, certainly by the end of this.
Sure, and Keldon Johnson, the coming year will be his age 23 season, so it'll be his age 24 and beyond. And we also got significant...
And by the way, nice find there with the number 29 pick, and nice job by Johnson working through to get a huge payday when he really hadn't made much in his career because he's the 29th pick before that.
We also got significant, I would argue more surprising Spurs news from friend of the pod Jake Fisher, that Chip Englund is leaving the Spurs at the conclusion of his contract. I don't think we know yet when the conclusion of his contract is, but these shot doctors have made a huge difference in a couple of franchises. We talk about Englund a lot. We talk about Fred Vincent a lot on the Pelicans. We don't know exactly what Chip Englund wants, what this is potentially him leaving means, but if he wants another job, he should be exceedingly sought after.
Yeah, now he is 61. It's been posited that maybe he's just going to ride it off into the sunset and particularly do that if this were in fact Pop's last year. So let's see. But yeah, he should be sought after. I think compared to Fred Vinson, who I saw working, by the way, with Dyson Daniels, and he's going to have some work to do with Dyson Daniels for sure. But I trust him to make some improvements there. Hey, Englund's work at Kawhi Leonard was his star pupil. Tony Parker became a very good inside the arc shooter, although never really a good 3-point shooter. And that's probably the biggest complaint about Englund and the Spurs in general, is that they didn't push guys to develop their 3-point shot as much, particularly like on the move 3-point shooting, the way say a team like Miami has done with a lot of guys. So I think, you know, he's had some failures too, like Kyle Anderson, although again, he made Kyle Anderson a pretty good mid-range shooter and he always had that potential, but and there have been other successes for sure. DeJounte is another guy too, who his three got a little bit better, but the mid-range got a lot better. So I don't think Englund's, his track record of success might be a little overstated, but still very good. And as you mentioned, I mean, for a real shooting coach with a real track record of success, to me, especially for a young team, like I might consider paying that guy more than the head coach, honestly. Like, you're not going to be in the playoffs, so you don't need some unbelievable tactician or anything like that. What else we got here?
We can continue on the extension front with Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, just acquired by the Denver Nuggets in that deal involving Monte Morris and Will Barton and KCP. 2 years, $30 million after this year. That fits under the extend and trade restrictions, and it means that the Denver Nuggets look like they're going to be a luxury tax paying team for the next couple seasons as well, which is something that we talked about the significance of that when they signed Bruce Brown. But so KCP, this will cover his age 30 and 31 seasons as presumably a starter in Denver.
Yeah, and KCP now finally is maybe getting pretty close to that offer that Rich Paul turned down, that I would have told him to turn down way back in the summer of 2017 as a restricted free agent, and then he ended up going to the Lakers on a series of deals there that fluctuated in value, and now signing another deal with the Lakers, moving to Washington. This last year was non-guaranteed. That got guaranteed. Now he's got another $30 million or so. So he's finally been largely made whole in the end, and he's played on some better teams than he would have in Detroit as well, and won an NBA championship. So it's worked out for him in the end. Yeah, another one that just seems like fair value. Also noteworthy that this will not prevent him from being traded. It is short enough and has small enough raises that will not be an issue. It only goes 2 years and doesn't have more than a 5% raise.
Which is also how it was legal for him to sign it right now, because he was just traded. So the extended trade rules kind of, they're kind of dual-sided in the sense that they prevent you from being traded, but they also, you know, if it's allowed right after a trade as well. And this is a second.
So this is based, and I think that probably helped it out too.
Yes.
Of just like, hey, this is the most we can offer you. And they also gave him the player option.
They did. That's where I was going to go. And so KCP, he could theoretically get out on the open market in 24, because this will cover the 23-24 season is the one that is locked in, and then he could become a free agent in 24 or 25, depending on what he chooses.
And let's note this too. We've seen Denver, they've done a number of these player options to retain guys, whether it's been Jermichael Green, whether it's Jeff Green or retain or attract guys, Will Barton as well, and you know, Jamichael Green, they did a series of player options with him, and then they had to pay to get off of that eventually, but they had his services for a couple of years, so this has been a tactic that's largely, I would say, had decent success for them, but also there's a possibility of it getting you in trouble, particularly for a team that's not going to be getting any cheaper.
Let's go from there to Oklahoma City, where fairly shortly before we started recording, Kenrich Williams and the Thunder agreed on a four-year, 27.2, very specific number, million-dollar contract extension. It looks like, per Joe Masato, that the final year of that is a team option, which is a parallel with Lu Dort. And Kenrich Williams, you know, his contract wasn't even fully guaranteed for the coming season, and then now he gets 4 years after that. And
I mean, remember how he even ended up in an OKC to begin with. He was the only reason he was there. He might not have even had a contract for that season, but they needed salary matching for the Steven Adams deal. That was back right when Steven Adams was making like $28 million. So they threw him in. It had to be a three-year deal, making like $2 million a season. I think the last 2 years were non-guaranteed. And he's been a great culture guy there. We questioned why he wasn't traded. I don't know that there was a first round pick for him, and now he's going to be part of what they're doing as a backup for.
Right, and $6-7 million a year for Williams, who I think is a rotation caliber player, is good money for him to lock in, but also for the Thunder, with where we think salaries are going to be going over the next couple of years. You know, there are some parallels here with Conchar, except that I think Williams has established himself significantly more than Conchar has, also older, which is a consideration. But also, this plus the Lu Dort deal changes the equilibrium a little bit for OKC in the summer of 23. The two deals combined knock about $15 million off of OKC's ledger, or off of their cap space for that year. Still have, you know, plenty if they want to get into it. So my rough estimate there is they're looking at about $30 to $35 million, and it would be very easy for them to clear more than that should they want to. And the timing on that could be fortuitous depending on how this year goes with Chad and Giddy and Shea and everything else. But these are real commitments that they're making to players. And
speaking of the commitment, though, I'm guessing there's going to be some sort of a non-guarantee or team
option. There's a team option on the last year. Yes.
Oh, that came out already.
Sorry. Yes. Yeah. There's a team option on that last year. So OKC, they're spending some money, but they're doing it on guys that they like. And OKC does have this time that they're going to have to spend money. But remember that it might be more of a temporary thing, because Giddy and, you know, the hope is that Giddy and Jang and Jalen Williams and Chet Holmgren are going to be good enough that they're going to sign significant second contracts. And so if it might be the Thunder's spending power might be a little bit overstated here. I think that's something to kind of think about over the next year, is that if Presti gives out a big contract, unless, of course, they move Shea, then the timeline shifts a lot. If they give out a big contract, let's say in 23, a long one, the last couple of years of that could run into Chad and Giddy and Poku, if he ends up being good enough, their new contracts via extension or restricted free agency. And so the cap will be going up, seems like, and everything else. But this team might be, the cake might be a little closer to baked in terms of salaries than something.
Yeah, that could well be the case. But this also isn't necessarily a free agent destination the way, say, Houston is. And they were very fastidious about building slowly the last time they did this as well. Also interested to see, they have the extension negotiations coming up with Darius Bazley now. I want to see whether he's going to get extended and whether he's part of their plans or not. I would be pretty reticent to extend him if I were OKC, because as we've noted, basically nobody's going to take a rookie scale extension for less than $10 million a year, and I would want to commit to Bazley with that. His cap hold will be about 13. Let's see whether he actually makes it as a main part of this rotation. Like, he's probably going to be playing behind Chet at this point in time. We'll see who you know, with some of the other fours that they have in here as well, how he's going to fit in with that group. And I wouldn't be in a hurry to send him.
We've also seen a number of high second round picks signing long term deals. Josh Minot, 4 years, $6.8 million. We'll have to see I haven't seen the guarantees on that. Caleb Houston signed with the Magic.
That's good for him to not be on a two way drafted at 45 at that point.
I was very impressed. We will talk about him when we do our summer league recaps. And then Jabari Walker, a real success story, 57th pick in the draft, and then was a part of the summer league champion Portland Trail Blazers, but parlayed his success there into a fully guaranteed year one, partially guaranteed year two, and non-guaranteed year three with the Blazers. So they're getting pretty close in terms of roster spot, guys. I have Jabari Walker as their 15th fully guaranteed contract.
That's a very nice deal for the 57th pick of the draft.
Right.
And he earned that with a nice summer.
Yeah, and Portland could theoretically open some up. Like, for example, Didi Luzada is 100% guaranteed. They could find a new home for him. And I presume the Blazers are going to trade at least one player under contract right now to try to deduct the tax. They actually should probably do two, would be the way to actually do it. And then you sign one to replace them eventually in time. The Toronto Raptors, I brought this up last time we recorded, kind of did a transactions recap with DJ Wilson. So it was another one of those partial guarantees, bring him in and see if they're going to make it. He got $250K. The Raptors have re-signed Justin Champagne, who did well for them last year. And Blake Murphy has done a nice job recounting this. You can see his Twitter thread on it, that it looks like the same story is going to be placed for the Raps again this year. So Champagne has reportedly $325,000 guaranteed. Delano Banton has $300,000. DJ Wilson has $250,000. Armoni Brooks has $50,000. And they can't fit all those guys on the Raps. And they still have, you know, some of their non-taxpayer mid-level. There are other ways that they could add talent. They still haven't signed Koloko yet, their second-round pick. But the idea of giving these guys enough money, you know, a significant amount that doesn't preclude them from other opportunities should be there. And you retain whoever does best. I really like it as an approach.
Yeah, absolutely. I really like that. And remember, Sam Decker and Isak Bonga last year, neither of them ended up figuring much in the end. But yeah, a lot of teams can benefit from a camp competition.
And we could even see them cut Svi in favor of multiple of these players. You know, like, I don't remember the exact roster spot numbers because I don't usually think about that until training camp starts. Like, I could see the Raps cutting somebody on a guaranteed contract if they really like these guys.
Yep, I think that totally makes sense. Did we do the Connaughton extension last time?
I don't think we did. So Connaughton, he opted in at for a lower, you know, we didn't expect that because we thought he could get more on the market and also years, not dollars, could have gotten more years. Instead, he gets a 3-year, $28.5 million extension that is going to kick in for the 23-24 season. It is proper to think about this as a 4-year, $36 million deal, I think, but he's getting more of a raise in year two than would have been allowed under the collective bargaining agreement. I'm less confident that structure is actually good for the Bucks. It's very good for them in the short term, if the idea of they're expensive now, we don't know where things are going to go. But now, like, the Bucks, as I kind of, you know, as I'm starting to estimate it, they're barely below the tax line even without Brook Lopez or filling out the roster for next year. So they're cheaper having Connaughton on discount this year, but they're going to get expensive for 23-24 and beyond.
Yeah, and let's not forget Chris Middleton could potentially be in the last year of his contract.
Sure.
As well. So this is something I'll probably talk more about it when we do the Bucks season outlook, but this could be a little bit of an inflection point for this group where, you know, if they have another second round exit this year, they still have Giannis, but he'll only be under contract for two more years after that. Not saying he's necessarily a huge flight risk, but this could be the last year of this iteration of the Bucks unless you see things change a lot. But maybe Chris Middleton would just opt into his player option as well if things go poorly for him. So they might look to move Middleton possibly, or they could just go out and win the championship again too. So, and you mentioned Lopez coming to the end of his deal. So it may be that they will be needing a reset, but they won't have a lot of ammo to do that. Let's see how this year works out for Milwaukee.
We neglected to mention, I brought up Josh Minot. Austin Rivers signed a 1-year minimum deal with the Minnesota Timberwolves and could be a factor in the rotation. We'll see how exactly he fits in once the Tim Connelly roster gets closer to completed.
Yeah, they needed just someone to replace that Patrick Beverley role, which he's not as good at as Beverley, and nor is he as good of a shooter, but just as someone who can kind of be somewhat of a defense specialist off the bench and at least bother guys a little bit for the minimum. That's a good role for him, and he'll be replaced in Denver in that role, it looks like, by probably Devon Reed.
Yeah, or, I mean, Bruce Brown, I consider an upgrade, but the idea of a defense.
Yeah, actually, you're right. Sorry.
Yes. Mark Stein had it that the league might investigate the Sixers for PJ Tucker. If an investigation comes, it's presumably from a complaint, and that complaint would presumably come from the Miami Heat, which would be notable considering they could have offered him basically the same contract from Philly.
And oh man, I mean, the pot kettle action in these Tampa, and this is probably just Miami being like, all right, fine, league, you're gonna fine us, make us go through all this bullshit last year for Kyle Lowry. Everyone's doing
yeah.
this.
Yeah, and so fine. And also, like,
do it again.
Happen to, you know, if you happen to get knock another competitor in your division, a second round pick. pick. You know, that the league's just going to do that pretty easily, then might as well do it.
They're not in the same division.
Oh, no, I mean, same conference.
How could you forget?
No, same conference is what I meant. Like, competitors. Yeah. They're competitors of each other. Yeah. And we still don't know the exact terms.
Eastern Division, right? Like, pre-1969, yeah. That's what you're talking about.
We still don't know the exact terms of James Harden's contract, but Chris Haynes had the reporting that Harden basically, I think Harden just told him, that he told the Sixers he would take whatever was left over after they did the things to make the team better, and it looks like that's kind of where the numbers are going to shake out on that 1+1 structure. And Harden sacrificing for the current year to have significantly better teammates will have an impact, and they're going to be, we already talked about this at length, but the negotiations that I think will occur in 23 are going to be hard to predict.
Yeah, well, and we'll see whether it's a good problem or a bad problem for Philly based on how he and the rest of the team form this year.
Sure. We also got an agent change that I think is significant around the league, and
this
especially
was so weird.
It was so weird. So, I mean, I'll let you talk about it first, I guess.
Yeah. So I just don't, Thad Fouché, I think it's how you pronounce his name. Only ever seen it in print because I don't really talk it something, but has been Russell Westbrook's agent. And for what has been an extremely successful career from 2008 all the way until now, Westbrook has made hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, navigated him through a few messy exits from places, getting in to a new place where he wanted to play, got him to LA, and Fouché released a statement basically slamming his own client of 14 years. It seemed like he was trying to get ahead of any narrative, in which he said essentially, LA is the best place for you. My position is you needed to change to do what they want you to do. You think there's somewhere else for you where you're going to get traded or you could go, or if you get traded and bought out that you could go where you get to let Russ be Russ again. That place doesn't exist anymore for you. I tried to tell you that you need to actually change your game and defend and play off the ball more and set some screens, all the shit that we've always wanted Russ to do and the Lakers desperately wanted him to do last year. He's not capable of doing anything other than that for a team that's remotely decent at this point. So that it's gotten to the point now where it's like even his own agent is trying to tell him the truth and he still can't see it, and then released a statement to that. I mean, that's the thing that I can't. When has an agent ever released a statement about to get out ahead of a player leaving him, basically slamming that player after 14 years? I mean, how weird must things have gotten that he felt like this is a good idea to do this? This has really gotten well beyond the point of, you know, the Russ stands and the versus the analytics people and what is Russ over underrated. I mean, it's getting to the point where it's just a sad end to this, like with Allen Iverson. That's who Jovan compared him to in this piece. And I think Tim has done that too, Tim Bontemps, where it's just, hey, when it goes and you're just too stubborn to change or evolve, like we may just never see him play in the NBA again, Danny. Like maybe that might be where this is headed.
It's so weird. I mean, to beyond all the stuff, like as many people listen to the pod know, like I went to college with Russell Westbrook, and I feel like, and I remember him as the Pac-10, I believe, might have been Pac-12. I don't remember, defensive player of the year, and the idea that he was he was the last scholarship offered on that UCLA team, and that he has had immense success. He is an unquestioned Hall of Fame player, deservedly won a regular season Most Valuable Player award, but could have a significantly different final act of his professional basketball life because he is unwilling to change his approach to be a smaller part of a bigger picture. And that could create tension for the Lakers this year. That could create tension for another team this year. And I hope it changes. I hope that, you know, what Fouché is getting at is the idea that there's still time and that things could go in a different direction. My instinct is that he does get another contract or two in the league after the current one, but the idea that his career will be shorter because he isn't willing to make the changes necessary seems a far more likely outcome at this point, and that's, to me, deeply depressing.
Yeah, but it's also, yeah, it's just deeply depressing. We can just leave it there. Also, on that score, hopefully not deeply depressing, but worrying at least, Arturs Karnišovas was on NBA TV during the Bulls-Raptors broadcast in Summer League, and he said that Lonzo Ball is progressing, but not at the speed that we would like, and
yikes.
Hope that he is ready for training camp, and recall that he had this knee surgery on his meniscus, second surgery on that knee, but it was a bone bruise that prevented him from returning. He just had so many of these false starts and then stops trying to get back, and it seems like he's still been going through that pattern, honestly. And there have been some other interviews with, I think one with Billy Donovan, in which the same thing was said. That's a concern. The Bulls are not doing anything this season unless Lonzo Ball is able to.
Right. It is concerning, and they do have other good players on the guard line, but you need all of those guys available. I mean, that was part of the story that we saw last year with Chicago, is even if they have their principals healthy, and Zach LaVine was dealing with some knee stuff, but they still need the ensemble, and Lonzo Ball is an important part of that ensemble, as are all of you, of course, the listeners to this wonderful podcast.
Also important to NBA players is actually getting paid, and you'll recall the way the league's escrow system normally works is there is a projection for basketball-related income. Players during the season only get 90% of their paychecks, and 10% of that is held into escrow, and then when you see how much money the players are supposed to get based on BRI at the end of the year, then they would get whatever percentage of that 10% back. In pre-pandemic times, with the cap rising and revenue rising, they generally would get that most of that back under this new CBA. And there's a band in which the players get between 51 and 49% of revenue based on how high revenue is. Then, though, the agreement for the pandemic season was that revenues decreased, I think, by about 33% in the end due to the pandemic season. And then there also revenue decreases the next year due to the lack of fans in the stands. So they basically agreed that escrow was going to be bumped up to 15% for the next few years. But the league's finances have recovered in a quite robust fashion, so the players are actually getting half of that 15% escrow. And remember, they're still paying the owners back for the owners essentially gave the players a loan during the pandemic, and they're still kind of paying the owners back, but they didn't have to use the full 15% to do that, apparently, according to Mike Vorkin of The Athletic. They only ended up having to pay 7.5% of their paychecks in the end.
It's great news.
So I wanted to do something fun here. Obviously, we've got off-season grades coming up, although there's a lot to get to still on that. We've got to go through all the important players. We try to do pretty much every full roster player that plays in summer league. That'll be a few podcasts, so we got all that coming up, hopefully, once we're going again at full throttle, and we'll try to make up to you some of the missed pods over the last week or so. But I wanted to do something here for the first time while it is fresh in our minds and take a look back at our top 10 players in the NBA. This isn't going to be a full list at this point, but just to go through, because remember, we do this almost as a playoff preview, and take a look at how generally the way the playoffs played out affect our view of that list, even if we're not necessarily going to reorder everyone in excruciating detail.
Sure. So my top tier was two gentlemen, Giannis and Kevin Durant. I had it.
I guess maybe we can do this as kind of like stock up, stock down.
Sure.
That'd be a good way.
So
our second Tim Bontemps reference. Mm-hmm. That was old school.
Yeah. So my tier one was Giannis and KD.
Yeah.
I would say the playoffs, you know, Durant had a very short-lived playoffs. They got swept, but I thought he looked reasonably good during that. So I'll say his stock is neutral during that time. And Giannis,
I would say for KD, I would say it has to be stocked down.
Yeah, maybe.
He had a really bad series.
He had a weak series by his series. Sure. I guess that's fair. And then Giannis,
and if you compare, because let's not forget too, KD, Giannis, and Steph all played the Celtics.
They did.
And KD easily had the worst performance of those three guys.
He also had significantly the worst surrounding talent, but he did have the worst performance.
Whoa, no, I wouldn't say that. Certainly not on the offensive end.
I mean, that they didn't have a theory of the case defensively. Like, they just didn't have guys.
Well, okay, but I'm not necessarily slamming him for his lack of defense. Well, a little bit, actually, I am, but
Tatum did do a great job on him. Like, we should give Tatum
I mean, like, he had some games where he just looked like he couldn't do anything, and
right.
He wasn't really able to contribute much defensively or on the boards. Like, that was the biggest reason they got cooked. And, you know, obviously he was playing, you know, 47.55 minutes per game at every game, but, you know, he had Kyrie Irving. Like, he had some other decent players out there. Like, had some decent shooters. Now, it sucked that they pretty much had to have two non-shooters on the floor at all times because of their defense, and, you know, it didn't fit together. But he had more offensive talent around him than Giannis, I would say,
with Middleton being hurt.
Yeah, Giannis had no, like, Drew was the only other guy who could run pick and roll with him, basically. Obviously, Giannis was huge on the defensive end for a lot of that series, when KD was not. So how would you
have Giannis's stock after these playoffs?
I would have to say probably stock up. I don't know how he realistically, within his capabilities, could have played better in that Celtics series. And even to get them, with how limited they were, to where they had a 3-2 lead in that series, and just some of the stuff that he was doing at the rim to the Celtics defensively was ridiculous. And yes, the Celtics strategy to some degree was, hey, let's let him get his. But, and they weren't able to get a ton of threes, but they also couldn't hit a three to save their lives either. Like, if they could have just converted some of these spot up looks, maybe it's a different series. And yeah, he ran out of gas in game seven in the second half. But given the incredible load that he had in that series, I think that's understandable. I mean, it was, that series to me wasn't quite at the level of KD's series in defeat against those same Bucks in 2021, but it was like one of the all-time like great martyr jobs that we've seen.
It was, he played incredibly well. And also the other reason why I would say it was a stock up is because he had an unbelievable playoff run in 2021, and having something this good gave us more, you know, it's kind of like the idea of you're fortifying the peak by showing this other thing that 21 wasn't a fluke at all. Like, that Giannis is just this damn good.
Yeah, and I think he really particularly fortified what he did in that Phoenix series. The free throw shooting wasn't as much of an issue either, which is huge for him going forward. So I would have Giannis, I think I would have him number one now, but probably not in his own tier. But yeah, KD's got to be stocked down. Like, he had a bad series. Like, if he had played to the level that we expected of him, that series probably is competitive.
At least more competitive.
And he wasn't able to impact the game in any way other than scoring. And, you know, he didn't really provide a great level of leadership. You know, I mean, if you compare the leadership of Stephen Curry and Giannis Antetokounmpo to where Kevin Durant has been over the last year or so. And I mean, also, like, even this trade request, like, that plays into this, right? I mean, if we're talking about the top 10 players in the NBA and we're talking about having a guy to lead your franchise for a whole season, like, this shit fell apart on Kevin Durant's watch.
My number three was Kawhi Leonard. His stock hasn't changed at all because he hasn't played in a damn game.
Yeah, how about number four, Luka Doncic? He's probably be stock up.
Stock up. I mean,
he was number four for me. Was he four for you?
He was four for me as well. And Luka, he got to face, you know, remember, we were so frustrated that he started off that playoff series hurt against the Utah Jazz, but I thought he did well once he recovered there and then was extremely important to Dallas's win over the Phoenix Suns, and not only on the offensive end, and they targeted him a fair amount defensively, but in the games that the Mavs were at their best defensively, Luka was not that much of a defensive liability, and he had trouble against the Warriors. The Warriors are a wonderful defense that ended up winning the NBA championship. I would say stock up for Luka. He had a strong playoffs.
Yeah, and even without much surrounding talent, he definitely, I thought, easily caused the most problem schematically for that Warriors defense, and also with the five-out system to play. But I think if you ask them, like, who is the toughest guy to guard that we face this year, maybe Jokic would be in there, too. He was pretty awesome in that first-round series. We'll get to him, at least on the offensive end. But yeah, I mean, Luka, getting that team, beating the 64-win Suns, basically completely bludgeoning them into submission, that unbelievable first half that he had in game seven on the road. I mean, that was incredible. I mean, and I think I might have him above KD. Maybe I'm being too harsh on KD, but again, we're not going to take official positions here. We only do that once per year. But he had a few defensive lapses. I think coming off the calf injury was probably part of that as well. So he did everything that you could have hoped. And when they finally got a bracket, not like it was an easy bracket, but when they finally got a bracket that didn't include like the perfect matchup against him, he was able to really influence some team success as we really hoped that he would.
Well, and I know this is going to be a very tough conversation. Stephen Curry, stock up or stock down?
So, well, let's just revisit where we were on him. I had him in tier two at number five, and I think to have Steph Curry as of that time, remember, he's injured right at the start of the playoffs. Everyone was thinking of him as the MVP after the first 2 months when the Warriors were killing it, but their fortunes went downhill. So did Steph's. He couldn't hit a three by his standards. We wondered, would Steph Curry be able to hit those sorts of shots through, and then he was coming back from the injury too, but through two rounds he was very good, but he wasn't able to hit those ridiculous threes. And then against Dallas and Boston, two teams who'd been very good defensively, particularly Boston, it clicked in. He had one of the all-time best final series, I would say. You know, only one bad game, just incredible efficiency. And you know, that game four is one of the best finals games that anyone has ever played, and certainly the team offensive performance that he drove, even up against Boston, it was amazing. But, you know, against like Dallas and Denver, where they're putting up, you know, 125 offensive ratings every game. And he also just showed the ability to like blow by basically anybody who could be switched onto him, which is another thing that we hadn't seen as much from him. Doing it a little bit different way, not so much the dancing, but just using his strength to turn the corner. He outperformed any possible expectations. They win the championship. But I think it was, even back then, it was people would pick, oh, but you guys really missed number five, Stephen Curry. Like, he's got to go up. I completely agree with that. But I think number five, and in a tier above Jokic, Embiid, and LeBron, would have been higher than just about anyone else at that point.
I think that's fair. And I think, was our next tier for both of us was Jokic, Embiid, and LeBron?
Curry is stock way up.
Yes.
He's got to be above Luka. He just straight up outplayed Luka at this point. His defense also like held up really well. That's another thing too.
Yeah, I mean, Steph Curry, it's not just like, can you be the best player in a championship team? He just was.
Yeah, so he's got to be above KD to me as well. Those guys are pretty much the same age. He played against the same team. I wouldn't say that he had worse surrounding talent on offense than KD, and he massively outplayed KD against the same opponent, and an opponent that actually that had Robert Williams playing in a lot of these games too. So really, it would come down to like Steph or Giannis. And clearly, if we're going to do this for next year going forward, Giannis has got to be higher than Curry because of just his greater regular season impact, and Curry's going to turn 35 in the playoffs next year. But as we're just saying, of like, we're kind of more looking back, like, how good of a job did we do at the time, and where should these guys have been at, like, based on what they did in the playoffs? Like, Steph and Giannis, like, neck and neck to me. I think I would go Giannis ahead of him. I mean, you get into stuff of like, all right, Giannis actually isn't that easy of a fit because he's a four who doesn't shoot. He needs a Brook Lopez or a Bobby Portis next to him, and that makes the team building a little harder in the playoffs. But he also didn't have anybody around him,
and he can also just be the five. I mean, we saw that too.
Yeah, but well, in some matchups, other matchups, he can.
Yeah,
but Steph also just had a completely ridiculous finals against what I would say is a superior opponent. That's an interesting question of like, is his series better than Giannis's series against the Celtics? Like, they're just such different animals that it's really hard to say that. I mean, both of those series were unbelievable. So I would probably still put Giannis number one, but they're in the same tier. It's splitting hairs to me. All right. Anything further to add there, or should we move down to the next group?
Let's move down to the next group. I had Jokic, Embiid, and LeBron. Did you have the same group?
Yeah, I did. And Jokic, the defensive concerns, just as big as they always were. He got completely traffic cone. They found a way finally in the last game of that series to defend a little bit better, but the Warriors couldn't hit shots in that series. They went out in a reasonable five-game series in the end. They were competitive the last three games. They were a complete joke in the first two games. A lot of that wasn't necessarily his fault.
Yeah.
He didn't play well in the first two games either, but I thought he did figure out Draymond, and his stats the last three games of that series on offense were completely insane. They had nobody else around him. He was going up against a great, great defense.
Right, and that's where I wanted to go. The degree of difficulty for Jokic individually offensively was incredibly high, and I thought he really did nail that. And so
though the Warriors were like, you know, finding their rhythm very much so at the start of that.
Yeah, I mean, Curry was coming off the bench for that series. And I think that Jokic, the way I would describe it is it's stock up, but not stock so far up that he's really threatening that top five. So I feel confident in the line. I mean, it also helps that the guys that I had at four and five, they pushed up even higher. Like they had strong playoff runs. But Jokic, he had a tough job to do. I thought he did it reasonably well. So I'll go stock modestly up.
Yeah, I didn't see enough to break him into the top five. I think offensively, if anything, maybe he proved more.
Well, I think those who were angry at us that we didn't have the two-time and regular season MVP, I don't think they got the ammo to really to bludgeon us with. Like, I think that's another way of thinking about this is, would people who were higher than us going into this get something, or would they lose something? And I think they would. I mean, because not necessarily because of how they lost the series, but he was great. But it didn't say like, oh yeah, Jokic can absolutely be the best player in a championship team if like with the defensive limitations if nothing changes.
Yeah, I mean, some of that defensive film was real, real bad. And now Steph Curry made a lot of people look very silly, but Jordan Poole also made him look completely silly as well. And he is a slightly different kind of player in that he can dominate dominate offensively, and you may have to double team him if you don't. And Golden State probably had better guys to guard him individually than most teams. But also, like, you can get away with playing Jordan Poole on the floor if you're the Warrior when he's out there, right? Like, he's not necessarily going to, like, punish any matchup on the floor in a way that stress tests your defense as much. But, like, he was amazing offensively most of that series, but he did absolutely nothing to assuage my defensive concerns, and in fact merely exacerbated. Joel probably got to be stocked down a little bit,
especially because he was hurt again.
And the broken face this is a little bit different. It was the broken face and the thumb this year, neither of which are kind of have much predictive power, but he didn't play very well. He did hit that big shot against Toronto. Like, he was, I thought he was pretty dominant against Toronto in that first series, even after messing up the thumb and like the way he ran the floor and stuff. So that series to me was a little bit of a feather in his cap, but then, yeah, I mean, he was just couldn't do anything really against Miami. He couldn't even get the ball after the first couple of games in Philly. And so I think this is just one where it's like, yeah, I feel totally comfortable with where I ranked him. LeBron was not a participant in the playoffs. So this is an interesting one, Danny, of, you know, Jason Tatum is the other guy who went deep into the playoffs here, who was in my top 10. I had him at 9.
I had him at 10.
So can you go Tatum above Joel based on what happened in the playoffs?
There were times in these playoffs that I thought you absolutely could. And Tatum, I mean, not only the offense, I mean, there were some supernova games for him, of course, but also the defense he played on Kevin Durant in the first round. And what was great, Tatum did get discombobulated by the Warriors, but so does a whole lot of really, really good players. And I think, so there are two arguments that I think are fair to put to move Tatum up and to kind of put him in this area. For me with Tatum, though, you get into these questions of, I think, are so salient in with Embiid, and I like using him as a focal point, of the value of positioning, a position and scheme versatility, where if Tatum is on your team, you can have a lot of different other really good types of players around him, but you can also have a lot of different theories defensively, and they're different, you know, like in some ways. And I brought this up when we did the top 10 players before, like Tatum's argument is a variation of the Anthony Davis argument that we had years ago, where I still don't love him as the absolute best player, but I love him as a number two much more than Joel Embiid. So yeah, I think he's worked his way into that conversation.
First two rounds in particular, and he did have some bad games against the Bucks, but he absolutely dominated against the Nets.
Great.
His individual defense against KD was ridiculous, blocking a bunch of times, and then that 46-point game on the road in game 6 against the Bucks was one of the best performances that you're going to see. But it's worth noting, and I think both Miami and Golden State showed this, that against switches, he's still not there yet as your a number one offensive guy. They really had to make it work more as an ensemble type of cast there. When he was able to go against conventional pick and roll defense or a bad defense, he was able to be really, really good. Now, we've never seen Joel in a conference finals. We've never seen him. I would say Jason Tatum's playoffs this year, whether you want to say that he had some warts in the last two rounds, may have run out of gas, etc., that playoffs far exceeded anything that Joel Embiid has ever done in a playoff.
Agreed.
Is that fair?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's not even close.
And I'm not as hard on Embiid sometimes in the playoffs as you are, but I still think that is completely fair.
Yeah. And again, we're at the point now with Joel, he's in his late 20s. He's never had a deep, good playoff run. Some of it's not his own fault. Some of it is injuries that are more, I don't want to say it's his fault, but are more something that could have predictive value going forward as well. Like, I think ultimately, like, Joel Embiid has never played as well as Jason Tatum played in the playoffs for much of these playoffs. So I think I probably, and then you consider the health aspect as well, you'd probably have to put Jason above Joel, even if Joel, I think, and also if you look at the impact metrics during the regular season, Jason Tatum and Joel are pretty close to one, right? In a lot of these. So yeah, I think Joel, it's like, it doesn't seem like Jason Tatum is as good as him, but I think he might have to be. And, you know, we're kind of leaving out these guys like Kawhi and LeBron. He didn't play Paul George as well. So Trae Young, stock up.
No, sir. And we wondered, because Trae Young got such a favorable draw in 21, you know, facing the Knicks, who didn't have the personnel to slow him down, and then the Sixers, who were limited.
Good defenses, but ones that had to play him conventionally.
That had to play him conventionally. How would it work if he played against a team that didn't have to play him conventionally? And the answer was dark for Trae Young.
He just fucking gave up by the end of that
series, too. Which is a significant demerit, too. Like, that he, you know, when faced with real adversity and just kind of packed it up and went home. That I don't love that about Trae Young.
He was pretty good in the play-in against the Cavs.
Yeah, he was. And so
I mean, not you know, I had Trae ranked in like the 11 to 14 range. Like my 11 to 14 was Trae, Ja, Booker, Lillard.
I had him 9. Would not have him 9 right now.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, you had him above Tatum and George, right?
I did.
Yeah, and also I think his defense was. I mean, we talked about the matchups offensively for him last year, defensively as well. He went up against three teams that really couldn't take advantage of him in the Heat. They didn't do it necessarily in the same way, but some of the stuff they did by just like running a cross screen with his man for Jimmy Butler that the Hawks just like couldn't deal with in any way. And like it was a big problem. And he'll play better, I think, in another playoff matchup. And the Hawks were so injured and out of gas. I mean, you know, with Capella and John Collins and Bogdanovich. So, I mean, he didn't have much of a chance, but like that fifth game, Jimmy Butler wasn't even playing. And it was just like, he was like not even running the play at the end of the game. It's just, all right, this is pathetic. Let's do two more here.
John Morant.
Yeah.
Stock up. I thought that he, you know, we got to see more of it in that Wolves series. It is an important note that the Grizzlies defense got significantly more stout when he got hurt. They got worse overall as a team, but that he is the weak point, and they were pretty damn good defensively. But I would say that the overall performance for him, you know, and especially considering in some ways that he was coming off of an injury, he had a little bit more time to recover. But I thought he did well enough in the Minnesota series and the start of the Warriors series. Like, there were times that they just couldn't stop him.
I would say stock neutral for a few reasons. One, he got hurt. Like, he was hurt at the end of the season. I don't know how much that played into him getting hurt again, but he couldn't finish that series. We were concerned about that. He had that huge dunk, obviously. They had those big comebacks against Minnesota. I thought that was a disappointing series in the aggregate, though, for Ja Morant, and not an amazing playoff defense. He was below 50% true shooting, 29 usage, 16% turnovers. That was disappointing. He had the one great game against Golden State where they won that game too, when they just never did anything other than send him left. And I thought he actually figured out some of their new coverages in game three, and then he got hurt. Like, he was playing very well offensively in game three, but then they couldn't stop anybody and had one of the worst defensive games playoff history in that game three against Golden State. So he's about the same for me, I would say, particularly with the injuries manifesting.
Last one to discuss, Devin Booker.
He did have the hamstring. That's a mitigating factor. Didn't do much in the last three games of that series. You know, he's in the 10 to 15 range. I don't think I would really change things.
I wouldn't either.
That much.
And there were a lot of reasons why that game 7 collapse happened. I don't put a lot of that at the feet of Devin Booker. Some of it, yeah, but not all of it.
I'm sorry. There is two other guys I'd say we have to discuss.
Okay.
Jimmy Butler's got to stop.
Oh, yeah.
I had him at 17, and no, I mean, he's got to leapfrog into that Tatum and George group at a minimum.
I think he does. It's sort of the Steph Curry argument where he does based on what we saw, but I'm not sure that he will a year from now because he'll be a year older.
Yeah. But again, if we're trying to predict how this playoffs is going to go, I mean, Jimmy Butler, yeah, he had some bad games, dealt with his own injury issues. That's part of why I had him ranked lower when we're talking about a full season and then a playoffs. But he did really dominate in all three series, and that game 6 against Boston, so an absolute all-timer. So he's not gonna be below Trae. Below Devin Booker. So no, I mean, you could talk about him and Tatum and George and even like, but he's got to be at least in the lower end of top 10. And again, like someone who I think really finally cemented a Hall of Fame case with his playoffs this year, if he had not done so already.
I would agree.
And then Bam Adebayo, I had at 18. I think you had him lower.
I did.
Would you move him up? I think it's hard for me to put him above some of these on-ball guys, but and his offense very much waxed and waned. He had one good game really against the Celtics where he took over, and other than that, didn't do much offensively. But I mean, defensively, he caused massive problem for whoever he was going.
Especially to me in that Hawks series, he was incredibly disruptive.
In any suit, like, there was nobody he was guarding at any time.
That was a problem.
Anything again.
Right.
I mean, maybe Joel ducking in every once in a while, but his relentless activity, like, he wore Joel out. Like, Joel couldn't even get the ball by the end of that series.
Right. So, yeah, I think I'd move him up a little, but I don't think it, like, pushes him into the top 10 or anything like that for me.
Yeah, Jaylen Brown would probably have to be moved up a little bit after this. I had him like way down in like the high 20s. Draymond was low 20s. I think that's probably about right for him based on these. Maybe he did have some offensive issues, so maybe I would. I don't know that I would necessarily move him up based on these playoffs, even though they did win the championship. Like he was up and down at times. Very, very good, very important. But I thought he was kind of properly rated. He probably higher than a lot of people would have had him to be. at 23 for me. Oh, Carl Anthony Towns.
I mean, we did see kind of, you could say, inspired by these playoffs that, you know, that Tim Connelly felt that he can't be the guy defensively. And those limitations were a key factor in how that series went. But Towns was also, he had some unbelievable offensive moves. So Towns' overall numbers, in case we've forgotten it, because that series feels like a lifetime and a half ago, 64% true shooting on 25 usage, or for those who like per game stats, 22 points, 10.8 rebounds, 2 blocks, 2.2 assists.
Yeah. Now, I will say he laid a complete egg in that game against the Clippers. The usage is too low, right? That's, even if he's efficient, 26% usage. And then the minutes are obviously too low from that series as well. So again, I would say stock down for him at least a little bit. I'm not sure like who I would move him below or anything, but it, even though he was able to score efficiently, there's also obviously problems defensively. They saw enough of him defensively to go acquire Rudy Gobert. that might be an indication of how he played defense in these playoffs. Sorry, we got to do a couple more here. I mean, Kyrie Irving's got to go down.
Sure.
He quietly had a terrible series against the Celtics as well. I had him at 20. Donovan Mitchell, I had at 21. It's probably rough. Might go down a little bit.
Slight bit. I would have him down, but not much.
Yeah.
I don't think he changes 22. Tiers.
He's got to go down for sure. Chris Paul, I had at 15, and I felt bad about having him below the Trey, Ja, Booker, Lillard group. And I, you know, he had some ridiculously dominant games at times, but he also just, my biggest concern why I had him at below that group was, can he really maintain that level of usage throughout a season, throughout a game, throughout a series? And the ultimate answer was that he could not, and whether it was because he was injured again in the playoffs, it's always something, but that's part of the legacy here too. And I mean, clearly that game seven is just a massive stain on anyone who was involved in it for Phoenix. But other than
except for Abdul Nader, he's scot free.
Well, he wasn't even on the team anymore.
I know. I was joking.
Yeah. All right. Well, some people might not. Okay. This is interesting to do, though. I mean, obviously, some of this analysis is going to very much affect what we look at next year for this. But really interesting to look back on a lot of this and see what was right. And you know, we kind of saw it coming with Curry, but not even enough. But I did still think he was good enough to lead the Warriors to a championship. I thought you did as well. And I think that was probably our best call of that ranking to have him even in that, you know, tier from 3 to 5. I think was we bet on him being able to still be able to do that, and that turned out more so even than we would have been. And probably biggest mistake is Jimmy Butler way too.
Right.
All right, well, this was fun. It's great to get back out here and actually talk a little bit. I made it through okay. I think I was still coherent by the end. Sometimes I can't even tell anymore, but we'll be back on the try to get you a few more. We're gonna do Spotify Live tomorrow for me and Danny, and then John and I'll be back on Spotify Live on Wednesday. John and I should be out again with another pod, and Daniel will get you at least one more this week, and we're going to start really getting into, I think, our summer league film. So and you know, as much as we can get done for you, we will try and get into you this week. Talk to y'all soon.